Hello, and welcome to the Ludic Insights podcast, Series 2. Series 2 is called What Now? And the series focuses on exploring the most influential perspectives and conversations regarding what now? What now since the huge pivot to digitally enabled life in 2020 as a result of the global pandemic? What now for individuals, society, and business? What now for healthcare, finance, energy, marketing, travel, aerospace, manufacturing, technology? What now? In the multiverse and the omni-channels and the inspiring, incredible, astonishing story of being human in the 21st century. In this episode, we're delighted to welcome David Perring from the Fosway Group. Hi, David.
Hi, good to see you again, Garrick.
And I'm joined by my fellow Ludic partner, Paul Ashcroft.
Hi there.
David, we're delighted to have you here. David is an expert analyst about all things learning and what's going on in the future of learning today. We last did a podcast with David in 2018, which is kind of crazy to think about. And a lot has happened since then. David, first question, what's changed in the past 12 months?
Wow. I think we've all gone through some amazing shifts, haven't we? I think we're now doing our virtual podcast in the way that in 2018 we were in the lovely location of the hospital club, which was a beautiful experience. The world has changed, turned upside down. I think from a learning point of view, I suppose the headline is we are all digital learning providers now. If you're in learning, then it is about digital learning, and that's been a huge shift, and lots of people have made some really fast transitions. We did a survey back last May time, and there were some really interesting sort of switches. 94% of people said they changed their learning strategy. 74% said they said an increase in demand for digital learning from their learners. 81% had increased demand from stakeholders. Everybody seemed to be adopting virtual classrooms. So it's been a massive shift and a steep learning curve.
It's a huge shift, David. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, as we spoke last time, getting people to adopt digital learning 2 years ago could be an uphill battle, particularly in some companies, whereas we've been thrust into it now.
Yeah. Some people said you can't really do learning online. That was a big trope.
Yeah. That
the most effective learning had to be face-to-face in some way.
Yeah.
But that seems to be proven differently now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's interesting, I think lots of organizations have talked to us when we've done our surveys and talked to them, that they've said they've almost had 4 to 5 years change in 6 months. So it really has accelerated their view. Lots of people were able to sort of just turn up the dial on what they were doing around digital as a learning approach. Some people had to effectively explore it for the first time anew. And what I think what's interesting is that it's not necessarily the digital revolution in terms of learning delivery that you guys would have probably helped people through with the richness of blend. It's what a lot of people have done is just taken a classroom model that worked face-to-face in the same space and have moved that online. So there's been a massive boom in virtual classrooms.
Yeah.
So I think we haven't necessarily quite embraced the new reality. It's a bit like putting the guy with a red flag in front of the car when the car first came out, so it couldn't go too fast. We've sort of adopted an old school model, but haven't all embraced the full potential of maybe a more digital learning experience in the complete way that you guys enable things, right?
So I like the way the term you use, digital learning experience, because we know that the research and even the analyst research come out that the groups are doing the best at learning online are the ones who are embracing online experiences of learning, less, you know, more different traditional learning methods taken online, make the most of what digital has to offer in terms of allowing people to build things and work together collaboratively.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think what's interesting is that there's almost a maturity curve that people go through where they start off and they almost emulate what they were doing before with the digital technologies. And as they get more and more experience, what they start to do is explore new avenues, which are much more collaborative, much more about how the technology can support communication, reflection, coaching, connect, and that whole sort of shared view of what it means to be active in work. And again, when we went to our survey last year, what was interesting is the number of people who thought they were mature or immature in their use of digital learning. And about 64% said they were immature in digital learning. So there is a long curve that I think people are still trying to work out what really works. And we are still embedded quite a lot in it being about content rather than developing skills and developing people's expertise.
If you had to put on the, if you've got a maturity curve and on the immaturity side, to use that term, it's simply just porting content and doing virtual classrooms online using Zoom or webinars or whatever. What would be at the extreme end of the maturity curve in terms of what you've seen?
Yeah, I think we tend to, we've got a model that we talk about in terms of sort of learning experience. And a lot of the things that we've seen people talk about as learning experience in the past has been about the UX and UI. So what does it look like? So Netflix of learning has been the phrase that people have used. I think as you move up the maturity ladder, what you start to do is embrace more peer-to-peer collaboration, more sharing, more teamwork. Maybe you start to think a little bit about having a blend of learning delivery and start to embrace learning cycles. So what I mean by that is things like input, action, feedback, reflection, input, action, feedback, reflection as a continuous cycle. And what that does is it breaks you away from just thinking about content into how you connect people, how you get their feedback, how you prompt them to review where they've got to, and then think about other inputs, be they self-paced courses or coaching or whatever it happens to be. So I think as you start to move right, you start to pick up this more collaborative sense of learning. And in the probably the right-hand-most side, I think you start to see some maturity growing because of people's adoption of AI. So it's about how you personalize and create maybe a bit more of a an individual relationship with themselves around learning and others. So I think that's the what I'd pick out as maybe the polarities, so to speak, of that learning experience being.
That's great. The interesting thing for me in terms of one of the things I reflect on in this this shift is about how we've all become learning organizations. And when you're disparate from each other and you spread apart by, you know, the pandemic and geographies and stuff. It's only really being a learning organization that enables you as an organization to shift, move forward and find ways to communicate with each other. You just try and apply the old style mechanistic models of organization. They just no longer work in this context, which is weird given that it's all enabled by technology. What do you think are some of the big shifts that are happening in organizations right now because of it?
Well, the thing is, I think we've seen some really major, obviously the, it's almost the, everything's changed. Whenever you've sort of used the, I was thinking about the, what's it, the five W's and the H for why, what, when, where, and how of work. Everything's up in the air because we've changed where we work. We've changed how we work in terms of the processes and mechanisms and the tools that we use. What we're working on in terms of, are we working on our role, are we working on projects? There seems to be a fragmentation of work which is emerging. And I think that's a, and when you add those things together, it sort of creates quite a lot of dysfunction. So are we effective as working as virtual teams, as hybrid teams? Most of the research shows that we're probably not as good as we should be, despite all of the hours that are spent in Zoom calls. People's personal stresses and sense of well-being has degraded over the last 12 months. So I think there's lots of impact of the hybrid workspace where people aren't always in the same place at the same time, which we haven't quite worked out how we lead in that environment, how we work as a high-performing team in that environment, and how we apportion work in that environment as well. I think that's all quite up in the air. From conversations I've had with a few organisations and some experts as well.
David, one thing that has certainly happened in the past year has been a heck of a lot of learning. Yes. From the people we speak to and the organizations we speak to, one of the things that from the individual level to what organizations are providing is more and more learning, whether that's, I guess, just using the time available, adopting to a shift. And I suppose it's been, in some ways, a huge experimentation in how to deliver the learning digitally. Can you say a little bit more about what you've seen people trying, what's worked? Will learning ever be the same again?
I think it's interesting you say that, Chris, because we asked in our survey, last May, and we've asked the same question again this over the last couple of months of, will learning be the same again? And when we went and asked it back in May, 6% said, oh yeah, we're going to go back to how it was before the pandemic. And now we ask the same question again with a larger number of respondees. Only 1% believe it's going to go back to what it was.
Yeah.
So this has changed forever. I'm sure we will see some people rushing back to the office, right? Because people have felt disconnected and disenfranchised, and actually how you make influence work at distance when you can't rub shoulders
with homeschooling.
Yes. And I know that's been a real challenge for so many people. But I think some of the things that we've seen people start to focus on, and it goes back to your point, Paul, is a lot of the focus around skills, upskilling and reskilling. So pivoting people not only in how they work a little bit. So what does it mean to be a part of a virtual team member? What does it mean to be a virtual team leader or a hybrid team leader? Some people work in the office, some people on the manufacturing line, other people are virtual. We've seen that sort of sense of how you upskill and reskill and pivot people into different roles. So for example, people in retail banking then being transferred into contact centers and virtual contact centers at the drop of a hat. It has been probably one of the most amazing stories for those organizations who've been able to execute around that. And there's some great brands out there on the high street that we'd all recognize across Europe who've done some amazing things to take people who otherwise wouldn't have had much of a job to do and put them into new roles to keep them busy and keep them active. And that's meant a lot of sort of virtual working tools. It's had a huge impact. Yeah. But people are still aren't doing that very well. It seems to have been quite a formulaic approach. So we're seeing that sort of grow, that whole upskilling and reskilling. I don't think that's going to go away. And we still got to get working virtual teams right. The other side around skills is just, what does it mean to have a career in organizations now? How are we developing skills that enable us to be employable in the future organizations? So that there is a strong strategic people development agenda. And I think that comes through from the work that you guys have been talking around curiosity. But having an agile organization which can flex, which has the skills to be successful in the future, people are starting to focus on those really aggressively in certain parts of the market space.
Well, there's that piece of research at HBR about how 90% of the skill sets you may have today will be redundant in 5 years' time from now.
Yes.
The skill set you use at work, which is shockingly aggressive.
Yeah. And there's some great things even in the latest World Economic Forum report from 2020. And they talked about I think it's about 60% needing to be upskilled in the next 6 months. So there's vast numbers of people who are sort of looking to need to upskill themselves and reskill themselves to be relevant in the modern workplace, which is partly driven by all the changes that have gone on. But also we've seen some quite interesting growth in providers looking at how they can provide what you might call skills intelligence. So using AI and machine learning to start to create an audit of organizational skills. People started to think about how they use question matrices to understand where people's skills lay, so that having done that, they can understand what people maybe should be doing other work, right? And what projects they should be involved in. So there's been a growth in people think about using AI matching around individuals to almost proactively include them in projects they might not otherwise have been involved in. So there is a push around talent mobility. And there are some amazing case studies from the guys at Schneider Electric and also Unilever around what they've been doing around that whole talent mobility space, which is linked to skills. And it almost sort of it works as a sort of a matrix, which is self-energizing, so to speak. So if you know what skills are needed by future projects, then you can start to invite people who've got close matches to be involved. You can also allow people to put their hands up to say they want to be involved in those future projects as well. Yeah. So you start to get a push around people's career growth. It's not just about project, could be gigs, could be roles as well. So we're seeing that as a push around how people engage with their future skills, rather than it being maybe a top-down push. It's almost a pull from the organization. And that's
talking about the pull from the, sorry, David. Talking about the pull from the organization, yeah. There's been a huge shift in appointing chief learning officers to the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's been growing at a massive rate in the last year.
Yeah. Do you think we're starting to see fatigue around this, David? I feel that personally. A year of working online, a year of doing skill building. You know, is there a shift to not just piling on more learning, but also focus on the experience around that and how it's delivered alongside the work that we're doing?
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, something we highlighted recently, we asked in our latest Digital Learning Realities survey, which we're still going live, but the initial results are about 67% of organizations say that they suffer or believe their learners are suffering from digital learning fatigue. 40% of those think that's got worse since the pandemic. The other 20% said it was already an issue. So, digital learning fatigue is something that has been recognized from our respondents to our survey. So it's something that we believe is out there. I think it's something that actually we spend so much time when we think about delivering digital learning as it being something that people have to go away and study on their own. I think that's part of the fatigue. It's not just about the Zoom fatigue, so to speak. I think it's about the self-study. And I think the other side of it is actually the way that we deliver in virtual classrooms is still quite didactic and broadcast, when actually if you embraced maybe a little bit more of a flipped classroom model, you would create a much more excited and energized learner because they're much more active. So I think it's something that's probably the challenge for the next 6 months, right? And probably beyond, is how we create more energizing learning experiences, maybe they're a bit more human. And I know you guys are very experienced in doing that because of the blended learning that you've been really sort of award-winning and been doing over the last 4 or 5 years.
Thank you.
Well, humor is something we like a lot. We call the business ludic because we like the idea of being playful. Yeah. But your point really takes us into our next big question. Like, what should we be looking at now in 2021? As we move forward.
I think there's a few things. I think there is something about skills and how skills are defined in your organization, how you link skills to learning, how you link skills to work, how you link skills to people's job opportunities and work opportunities, how you link skills to performance, how you link skills to feedback. Because actually what you can do is maybe create a little bit more of an ambient reflection of how we have or don't have the skills that are required and what proactive steps we're taking as individuals and teams to build on those. And I think there is an agile mentality we can bring to that, which is actually quite energizing as well, both in caring for each other's development, but also think about these things as being like a 2-week sprint, right? We think about agile sprints as put something out. I think we've all got an opportunity to think in that mindset, not think about eating the elephant of skills development, but what are my priorities? How can I get feedback? How can I connect? How can I elicit feedback from other people and engage people in my learning and connect around my learning with other people? So I think that's part of our, antidote to fatigue.
Yeah.
And I think, engaging people again is part of this. We've all been apart and working separately for so long now, sort of how we reintegrate ourselves back into whatever the hybrid workplace is going to be, how you onboard new people into those organizations.
Exactly. And it's interesting, one of my ex-work colleagues is a lovely gentleman. He's working at a legal firm. They've just today released a mentoring solution to enable people to connect across the business to support each other's development. And I just thought of all the things that you could do at a time when this hybrid uncertainty is kicking around and the distance is being felt by people. What a beautiful thing to do to encourage people's development, create that mentoring support network. And I think that's something that we probably should focus a little bit more on.
You mentioned the word ambient just in passing, but I heard it go past and I want to come back. Because ambience in the workplace and certainly technology, whether it's the ambience that you create by surrounding yourself with a number of screens at your desk, whether it's the ambience of being in a lab and surrounded by others, or being in a factory, or in a hybrid workspace. Ambience is interesting for me because it reminds me of conversations we've had with Josh Burson, who talks about learning in the flow of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, the hacking of the kind of 70-20-10 principle, which has been the heart of things, like it used to be said, 70-20-10, most of the work that gets done, the best learning is achieved by being in the workplace or doing the job. Yeah. But this thing about learning in the flow of work and ambience and how learning might flow into the information that is surrounding us when we are learning and working in the moment. Do you have a view on that?
I think this is, for me, the ambience is just trying to make it part of the natural rhythm, if that makes sense. And I do feel that if we put too much reliance on just not being in the flow of work, right, you're almost so absorbed by work that you don't get a chance to reflect. So I think it's about trying to create some space, but part of a natural conversation with people rather than sending them to be on their own, which actually creates a much richer learning experience. And again, we know from research we've done over the last 2 years where individuals didn't feel before the pandemic that they had enough space to learn. And that was just, I think some of it's just actually saying, just step back. Because sometimes when you're in it, you don't realize what the hell's going on around you, right? You're just in the moment. But it's not till you step back from the moment that you can get really reflective and think about what you really need to change. So I think if we can just build a little bit more space, that's probably a good idea, but that's not an easy thing to do when people are so busy and the pressures of work are so intense. But I think we get caught up with it. And I think that this sense of learning in the flow of work, there's a lot of performance support tools that people can think about, right? And you can think, oh, what knowledge do you need to be, what input do you need, what more contact do you need, what advice do you need, and always the input of learning. And sometimes that is relevant because if you're in the moment, you may need a memory jogger to remember to do something. But I think this, in this sort of learning cycle view, right, of you get some input, you do need some feedback, you do need some reflection, and you need to think about your actions as well. So if you're not tying those bits together, or you're just getting a saturation, and I'm not sure if that's a good way.
This is astonishing. It really make a fantastic point about learning in the flow of work, and the focus is on input and flowing, or you know, turning on the fire hose of information for people. Yeah. You want to talk, but there's a huge but that, that you mentioned, and it's this other stuff that has to be paid attention to as well. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
So I think that, like I said, that the guy who's just he's working this global legal firm, and they're just releasing this sort of mentoring capability. So actually trying to connect people and encourage reflection and exchange, right? And is, I think, a wonderful part of learning in the flow, right? So if we actually get people to observe what we've done and then give us some feedback and help us reflect on what we could do different next time, I think there's a nice combination of input, caring, and space to think, which is really important. And for all of the micro video learning, the little 10-minute chunks that we can keep on pushing down people's heads, ultimately, the thing that changes us is our impact and reflection about how what we do with people, not the knowledge. So there's a sort of transition, I guess, from knowledge into skills and then to behaviors. And behaviors is the big step. And I think that's where we usually need a bit more permission and a bit more support to make that change.
That's really insightful.
Agreed. David, let's look ahead.
Yes.
Let's look ahead beyond what is a 2021 that is not progressing as quickly as we would like, perhaps. Let's look ahead to 2022 and beyond. What are some of the things that we should be thinking about in the coming years?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that have gone under the radar for a few years. Some of this is pre-pandemic, right? And I think they're just really interesting things that we can take away. So the first is Paul Kelly and his view of spaced learning. He wrote a wonderful paper and did some fantastic research around space learning technique, which his research shows almost puts short-term memory, short-term activity into long-term memory. If I could bottle this for my son, who's just about going his first year of A-levels, I think it'd be a massive breakthrough. I still need to work a little bit harder on that. But what they found was people who'd gone through about 1 hour of space learning using Paul Kelly's technique outperformed those people who'd spent 4 months doing the same subject with standard teaching.
And could you say, what did he describe? How did he describe spaced learning?
So it was all about within an hour's duration, people had 20 minutes input. They then had 10 minutes of neutral activity. So they weren't taking more input in. And what they then did in the follow-up was apply or activate their learning with some practical activity. So they were creating space for the memories to be laid down, and then they were applying those memories in that short amount of time. Mm. So it was all part of a very simple method. A lot of it was spent really not doing so much. So they play games, things that were quite brain neutral, but weren't that heavy on the memory, just to create time, I believe, to let the tendrils of the neurons start to do their work and not get distracted. So that's what he worked on. He's got, if you type in Paul Kelly, space learning, his research is freely available. He's got some wonderful charts about test scores and standard teaching approaches and how they approached it. He's a lecturer, UK lecturer, and I think he's open to anybody, right, to pick up on what he's been up to. He's also big on circadian rhythms for kids, so teenagers not going into school until maybe 11 o'clock because they're not really awake. So he's a innovative thinker.
I will check it out.
Worth checking him out. Space Learning, Paul Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y.
I have a feeling Paul's kids are going to be.
I think it's a good one for
back
my kids.
In the lab.
Well, they're going to enjoy being told that they have more time not learning and reflection. That hopefully doesn't mean more Netflix. What about technology? What about technology? Is there some? Is what's happening on the old VR front, AI? All of
there's some really cool things out there, and I think when we think about what virtual and digital learning is, there's some really nice things around scenarios. And whether that's a practical scenario of driving a train on the underground or being a gas engineer, or equally using video and AI headset scenarios around delivering bad news or playing back particular scenarios around handling a particular situation, there are some amazing things. There's a company called Tailspin, like the story Tailspin, who are doing some really interesting things. And what's interesting for me is we're seeing this sort of combination of interacting with a scenario, choosing options, and it becomes quite a visceral experience because you get a real reaction from a virtual character. And the things that we're seeing evolve beyond that is actually the videoing of you to performing those pieces of feedback as well. So it's not only virtual reality and scenario based, how you behaved and presented yourself when you gave that piece of bad news, you can also watch back. So the richness of the thinking or rehearsing and preempting that scenario and understanding what tweaks you can make to your behaviors, I think is potentially huge in how we deal, especially in this virtual world as well, right? So I spoke to some guys from a Dutch bank three or four years ago, and they were working with a thing called Fur Hat. Again, if you put Fur Hat into a search engine, I'm not sure what you'll get back, but there was they were using a fur hat on top of a mannequin, but they were recording the individual give bad news about a loan opportunity to a customer. And the AI was interpreting what they were being given as the bad news and responding. So it was a real experience. And it was a bit jittery, but they said the sales guys and the people who owned that sort of process, when they had to rehearse it, really got into the moment because it's real, right? They're going to face a customer that they're going to have to say no to. And it gave them a great way of experimenting without offending. And
we're starting to see this in some of the best games, you know, with PlayStations, Xbox, if you can get your hands on one, you know, even Cyberpunk 2077, which obviously has sort of been pulled for a while, but a really immersive role-playing game where it's almost real life scenarios. You imagine that type of experience being played out in a learning
And it's interesting context. With the Tailspin one, that one of the scenarios I remember sitting down and going through with the headset on was you had to tell a grey-haired guy like me that they were going to be made redundant. And then it was a whole emotional roller coaster of their reaction. And it was really quite sobering, because you could imagine transporting yourself to that situation and thinking, okay, that's something I've got to do. And we've heard of other sort of environments where people have been doing that with other professionals who deal with difficult situations to get that rehearsal time in, which is an important part of learning, right? If you want to learn something, it's not just about knowing. I can watch as many videos or read as many books about horse riding as I like. It's not until I sit on the beast that I know how badly it feels to fall off.
You talk about AI tools. Do you think we're heading rapidly towards AI curating bespoke learning?
Yeah, I think we're probably already there, to be honest. I think we're getting very, very close.
Where do you see it happening?
Yeah, there's a few things. So there's things that are being done basically around skills that are helping people identify what solutions and learning paths they might go through. You have the content curation engines that are starting to pick up on people's preferences and interests and starting to create almost like a news channel feed. You're getting much more adaptive learning solutions. There's some really interesting ones out there from Denmark who are starting to play. It's an emerging area, and I think it's still finding its sweet spot. But I think if we get to 2030, and I haven't retired, I think we'd be talking about this as being something that is much more mainstream.
Do you think it's kind of combine, David? What some folk have been asking us is, well, we still have to have real people running the training sessions. Is there a way of delivering this through? I'm not sure I want that future myself, but is there a way of delivering that through virtual reality or avatars?
I think we're invariably human characters, aren't we, ultimately, right? So the reward is that we meet and interact. Unless you're uber introverted, I think we all crave to be together. So I think that I don't think we'll ever see the negation of needing people, right? That's not going to be, we'll need that a part of the real rehearsal and the real connection. I just think we'll find ways of making some of the learning a little bit more engaging, because we place our people more in the moment. My kids spend hours playing games, trying to switch it off. It is part of the new zeitgeist, and they don't do it because it's not interesting, so to speak.
I think the future is that's a new reality. The kids all play hours playing games.
Yeah.
And whether they're stealing your iPhones to do, Temple Run, or they've got, on the big screen TV, they've got stuff going on. I mean, they're all at it. And I think, or do you think one of the ways to do that is to take the battle to the situation? And what I mean by that is we'll find ways to flow learning more and more into the games context, so that they not only play games which they enjoy, but they also come out fully prepared for society, perhaps with a degree.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's difficult to see. I think that there are certain things that people need to be able to rehearse. And I think sometimes that rehearsal, we can find time to do that individually. Ultimately, it becomes real when we're with other people. So finding a reasonable balance, a reasonable blend, I think is where it goes to. And if it means that my kids are going to be learning how to influence a key stakeholder by talking to a piece of AI, I think they're going to do that, because actually that may work, right? But it's not until they sit in front of their leader and start to make their pitch, and their leader says, this isn't going anywhere, but they're really going to know if they've learned it. So I think we need to find that sort of positive feedback loop from people as well.
Well, we know it influences behavior. You can just see how sometimes the kids forget that they're not in the game world anymore. Sitting at the table, for example. Certainly the expectations for instantaneous gratification. But one of the other things I think about 2022 is blockchain, of course. I mean, that's a huge trend. We know it's trending in all kinds of areas. Do you there was some talk a few years ago about blockchain and creating personal indexes for people, or some kind of technology like that. So whether you're playing your guitar on YouTube course or LinkedIn Learning or Cornerstone or wherever, or something, you do a TED talk or you do a masterclass series, something, all these different opportunities for learning somehow get logged and then add to your personal, as far as I understand, they add to your personal index of, like, you've got an MBA, but you've also got a pottery course from YouTube. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's all there as a record that you carry around with you. Do you think that's a realistic thing, or we might go there?
I think that's coming. I think it's that some of the big players in the software market have already invested in almost a foundation, so to speak, or a consortium, but an independent group to start to see how that could come to life. At this precise moment, I've completely forgotten what the name of their group is, but effectively what they're doing is working out how blockchain can do precisely that, based around corporate systems and other platforms as well. So let's see. I think it's a bit like SCORM and LRSs and Tin Can. I think it may take some time, but if these guys get behind it, I think it will go places. And a lot of that, I believe, comes from people wanting to understand how they can leverage their insights into individuals to create talent pools, and how those talent pools could become something that is a differentiator. So if you're a Workday or an Oracle or an SAP, we've got a great pool of people who work for lots of people. Do you want them to come and work for you? And I think that in whatever form that may be, whether it's a gig worker or a contractor, I think that will drive some of the effort, not just the personal indexing of me. I think it'll be about employability and being in the right talent pool, getting picked up, being invited to work on particular projects. I think that's where it's going. And that may be not in your organization, but in other organizations as well.
David, as ever, it's been fascinating chatting to you. As we close, one more question from me. We call this podcast series What Now? So my question, if you were to give us one big what now, do you expect to see in the next 12 months or so, what would that be?
Oh, I think if you had to do something now, I think it's about taking your L&D eyes, if you're in that space, just off the L&D space in its own right, and starting to look at the other connections across the employee experience. So understanding about onboarding, thinking about how skills leads to employability, thinking about internal hiring, thinking about performance, thinking about employee engagement, and really looking out there to say, how can learning play a more important role, provide an X factor to any of those other processes? Because that gives you a pull around learning, but it also provides a great deal of energy for organizations. I think the big challenge for organizations is really over the next probably 3 years is to think about how we energize our people. And learning has a really strong role in doing that, whether it's about management behaviors or how we behave, our skills. It's about optimizing how we work. So thinking about reinventing work to some extent, reinventing what we do, reinventing how we work, all these things about optimizing work is really important. And the final bit is, what intelligence do we have, whether that's data and insight and semantic understanding around, actually, are we energizing people and are people that are being more optimized at work? I think those are the three things that sort of come together. And I think skills is really underpinning quite a lot of that activity. So that would be my short answer. Too many words.
Oh, fantastic.
David, as always, fascinating. You give us insight into what's happening, what now, and what's happening in the future. Yeah. People can reach out to you at LinkedIn if they need to.
By all means. Because we haven't even mentioned. Yeah, but David Perring, via LinkedIn. That's cool.
David Perring of the Fosway Group, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening to the What Now podcast series. Subscribe to the series. Remember, we're asking the big questions about what should we be doing? How will we achieve these? And what are some of the weak signals that already exist that may show the way forward? What now? If you're interested in submitting questions, please do so by pinging us directly at our LinkedIn page on the Ludic Podcast What Now page. And you can also submit names of interesting people and projects that you believe we should feature on this podcast. We'd be delighted if you join our conversation.